I will empathize with you because my voice is so loud. I'm told I have this radio voice. I think Nick has it too. Like, even when I'm in the office, I have to go into the conference room to make a call because I'm unable to lower to some kind of whispering tone. It's just not me. So I have to go to a separate space so I don't disrupt everything else.
I do like, I mean, most of the time I like your loud voice. You're very enthusiastic and joyous, except for when I'm busy. Then I'm like, shut up. Anyways.
Well, I'm glad you all have a space, have the space to be able to be apart. Cause I mean, like what you just described, yeah, it might not have the backyard or it might not be a, you know, a house or whatever, but in Cleveland, that's really good. And it sounds like you have places where you can be separate from each other. Cause much like you were
in
your first place.
Absolutely. And we live in, and I'm sure yours is similar, but we live in a very walkable neighborhood. Walk to the grocery store, you know, we can walk to the Indians ballpark and the Cavs arena and the Browns stadium all within 15 or so minutes. So very convenient.
Yeah.
In love with movies, in love, in love, in love.
Danny and Nick.
In love movies. Da, da, da.
All right. Well, I guess that is a good segue then. We might as well actually start the podcast. Welcome, movie lovers. This is In Love with Movies.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Danny. Are we doing that bit again? Two podcasts in a row?
We didn't do it last time.
Okay. And we are joined by a friend of ours, Patrick Shepherd. Say hello, Pat.
Hello there. Honored to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
And Danny, just real quick before we continue talking with Patrick, what is this podcast? What do we do here?
Oh, yeah, we talk about love and movies.
We talk about love and movies. And we are joined by Patrick today for a conversation about love of prestige movies or the sort of more award-worthy. And Patrick is joining us because of his role with the Cleveland International Film Festival, a place that, like many other film festivals during award season, is a place where, you know, lots of those prestige films kind of get a foothold that people actually get to watch them. So Patrick, why don't you go ahead and start off with telling us about CIFF and what it is, what its goal is, what its mission is, et cetera.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the festival. So our mission is exhibition and education. And in any given year of an in-person festival, we have north of 100,000 people that attend our festival. You know, we have films from around the world. There's a lot of documentaries and English language as well. We, of course, in this pandemic era are entirely digital. So this year we're going to run from April 7th through the 20th. Although for the first time, we are going to be able to present films to people living across the United States. So we're going to have 116 features and just over 180 short films, and some of those will have geo restrictions that maybe you can only watch in Ohio or adjacent states, but the vast majority of the program can be watched anywhere in the country on demand, you know, all the US and US territories as well. So we're looking forward to launching on April 7th.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, like, I think we were talking a little bit before we even kind of started the official conversation that the advent of certain, there is a silver lining to things like this with regards to the pandemic. I mean, I'm sure you're probably reaching a potentially larger audience even than 100,000. That's, I mean, already big, but how'd that go, or how's that go, or what is it looking like for this year?
Yeah, well, just as a point of reference, last year we had just over 42,000 streams, and we count a stream as being 70% watched. So it's not like you just click on and we count that.
Sure.
And the industry norm is to multiply that number by 2 or 2.5. And the interesting thing is if you multiply it by 2.5, you get to almost exactly what our in-person number was in 2019, which was just about 105,000. But you know, what's really unfortunate in the pandemic era is the fact that we don't have any filmmakers coming to engage our audiences in person. And that's really what makes a festival special. I mean, certainly you can go anywhere and watch a film, or you can watch it at your home on a big TV or your laptop, your tablet. But, you know, it's that audience engagement with filmmakers that makes the space truly special. And of course, we're going to do everything in our power to have as many engaging conversations with filmmakers. Some will be pre-recorded that will release on demand. Some will be live happy hours on selected weeknights where the audience can come in and ask questions. But we're really looking forward to going back to the in-person festival next year, where we can start welcoming filmmakers. And in previous years, it would be hundreds of filmmakers from around the world engaging our audiences here in Cleveland.
Yeah, that's very cool. I had a friend who worked for Paramount. So I'm, just so you know, I'm not going to be much help of this conversation, because according to Nick, I don't like prestige movies.
We started this entire process for what I would call her cinematic education. I was constantly having to like convince her to watch what I considered to be good movies. And this includes things like The Unusual Suspects, which she came around is just the one I always think of. She was like, oh, that was a really good movie. And she would have never watched it if I hadn't insisted upon it. But even like a different level of prestige than what we're talking here. Anyway, continue.
Sorry. I have a friend who used to work for Paramount in Chicago, now works for Paramount in LA. And she would always give us free movie tickets to these screenings. And I was like, eh. And Nick was like, no, let's go. And I agree with you, like getting to see the people who are either in the movie or made the movie just made it that much more exciting. And we got to see like, what's his name? Loki. What's
Tom Hiddleston.
Some other people.
You really liked the conversation with the actresses from Patty Cakes.
Patty Cakes. That was a good movie. Yeah. Bridget Everett and her name's Danielle something or other. And then Swiss Army Man. We got to see that before anyone else. That's the one that stands out for me.
Swiss Army Man. That was.
Yeah. And just like seeing other people have the conversation about the movie made me like it more. I don't know if like it. Understand it more.
I'd give you a like it. I mean, we've talked about this before. Part of the thing I somewhat condescendingly, but mostly jokingly try to say, you know, cinematic education, even movies that it's like, you don't love every bit of it, or even ones that are kind of, you know, fodder, you know what I mean? The she's the man's of the world. There's something to be appreciated the more that you know about sort of the craft of filmmaking. And so even if you don't like the movie on the whole, you might be able to appreciate the cinematography that was going on, or, you know, kind of the storytelling that was happening, or the choices. Like, for example, the American Factory we'll be talking about today, there's some notes that I had just in terms of the documentary filmmakers' choices of like how and what order they presented things in. You know, and I think the more you understand those things, and you don't get to understand those things unless you have conversations with filmmakers or see those kinds of conversations that come from film festivals or things like that. So
yeah, that was a lot of words, Nick. So Patrick, how did you get into doing this, working for the Cleveland International Film Festival?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm probably the worst poster child for a career development that is around. I will say that. Nick knows that I went to Bowling Green State University. And while I fundraise for a film festival, which is a nonprofit, I never took a nonprofit class, a nonprofit administration class. I never took a film class. I never took a fundraising class. But what I did do is I volunteered a lot in the community, and that connected me to a friend of a friend who was looking for somebody to do the lowest job on the totem pole back in the 1998-1999 cycle. And that led me to work for the festival seasonally for 3 years. And then I was hired full-time in 2001 for a fundraising job that I was totally unqualified for, but managed to do well with it over time. And this will be my 23rd festival this year, which is almost hard to believe. But I love the organization. I love what it does for downtown Cleveland. And so many of the films that we present are so important for people to see, like American Factory, which is the topic of the focus of our conversation today. And to your point about people engaging the audience after the film, we had the Midwest premiere 2 years ago, and not only were Ohio's most prolific documentary filmmakers Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichert there to engage the audience, but so were six people who had worked at the factory. So many of the people that you saw in that film on a regular basis, you were able to ask questions in the audience. And then they, even after we had to turn the auditorium over for the next screening, they just they just stood in the hallway and answered people's questions. And that's what happens at a film festival. You see a film and you're inspired, or your ire is raised because you want to do something. You want to see more justice for people. And it's a motivator. That's for sure.
That's super cool. And I think you're a poster child for doing what you love. Maybe not career development, but you haven't worked a day in your life because you've loved so much what you do. I don't want to speak for you, but that's what it sounds like to me, that you just love something so much to be able to make it your full-time job, which is very, very cool.
And what is your technical title, or what do you do now as a full-time employee for CIFF?
Yeah, well, nothing to do with programming, I can assure you of that. But in a normal year, we have about a $3.5 million budget, and it's my job to raise that money.
Okay.
Kind of community engagement. For example, this year we have over 100 nonprofit organizations that are promoting various films in the festival because their mission and work ties to the topics in the film. So I help manage that program, and, just kind of anything else as needed, if you would. But there are 7 full-timers.
As assigned.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I'm one of 7 full-time staff. It's a much smaller seasonal staff this year. In a regular in-person year, you'd have over 300 seasonal folks and 1,000 volunteers. So we don't really have any volunteers this year because you don't need volunteers in the virtual space. But next year we will when we open at Playhouse Square.
Well, I still have to actually come attend. You've invited me more than one time, and I think the first
time... What is wrong with you, Nick?
Well, I think the first invite, if I remember correctly, and I may be wrong about this, but I want to say it was after I'd moved to Chicago. And so just like, it felt like such a, you're in the middle of grad school, you got to go do this thing. Yeah. Now being a little bit more established, I can sort of be more selective with, vacation times and things of that nature. But that conversation piece, I think for me personally, that's the reason I think a lot of people are like, oh, streaming is going to be the future. And maybe this is my old guard way of looking at things, but the thing I miss most, and Danielle can attest to this, I miss going to theaters just in general, is the experience that you have, even if it's not a conversation with the filmmakers afterwards, just the experience of being with other people at the same time, experiencing whatever that film is. And then part of the reason I really wanted to do this podcast too, is like, then the conversations you have with people about that movie afterwards, like you were saying, how it moves you, how it motivates you, what are your sort of reactions to it? What are your thoughts on it? And that's what the second half of this podcast is always about. It's like, what are your thoughts and reactions to a film that you have seen? So,
yeah, Nick, I love you, Nick.
But
something's coming.
Never understood. He always wanted to stay at, like, in the theater or outside the theater, or just like with people discussing the movie for a couple hours. And that was just not my thing. But I think that's why I don't watch movies that challenge me and my thinking a lot. I just go to movies for, like, is it going to entertain me? So I am glad that we have this podcast and we've been able to connect to other people, because it's made me watch movies that I don't think I would have watched on my own. Cause I'm like, let me watch Grease for the 7,000th time instead of like learning something new. So,
yeah. So well, go ahead.
I will say this, you will have an opportunity to participate this year virtually from your own new home. Because as I said, most of the program will be able to be watched from across the country. And then either next year or in a year not long after that, we'll invite you to Playhouse Square. It is the second largest performing arts district in the country outside of Lincoln Center in New York City. And the fun thing is some of those theaters were built in the 1920s as movie theaters. So when filmmakers come from around the world, they're going to be in spaces that we're running movies before there was even sound on film. And they're just incredibly beautiful palaces. I mean, there are some newer venues in the space, but they've got a total of 11 different venues. And we won't necessarily be in all of those in any given time, but it's a very vibrant performing arts center right in the heart of downtown Cleveland.
That's fantastic. I did not realize that it was the second largest after Lincoln Center. That's really amazing.
Yeah, number of seats. I think that the measure there is number of seats.
Sure. That makes sense. Have you been to Cleveland, you asked?
I don't know if I've been to Cleveland.
You went to Cleveland for the Gatto's wedding. So I think the Gatto's sometimes listen to this.
They'll
be happy to hear their names. And that's, we went to Great Lakes Brewing Company downtown. And well,
that's in my neighborhood.
Oh, is it really?
It's not only is that in my neighborhood, but right next door is where our offices are, which I'm not at right now. But
it's funny you mentioned that. I swear to God, I think I remember when we were there, I said something. Yeah. I was like, hey, I actually know that. And I was like, I know who works there. I noticed you personally, when we were talking about movies to select for the second half, picked documentaries and also picked shorts. So I did end up watching Last Truck this morning. And like in the process of doing that, was like prepared for, you know, another 2-hour movie and realized, oh, it's 40 minutes. So I'm curious, is that something you prefer personally? You normally go for sort of those more indie type things for that instead of like popular and big blockbusters, you personally? And also, do you prefer shorts personally?
Yeah, I'm not a big commercial movie theater guy. I do love the Star Wars series, so I'll probably watch anything there. Star Trek as well. So there's a little bit of the sci-fi thing, but I really favor documentaries of any length, whether it's a short or a feature. And you'd be surprised how much you can pack into 10 or 12 minutes. That film that was part of our program last month, A Concerto as a Conversation, is nominated for an Academy Award now. So I can't wait to see what's going to happen there. And we've had many Academy Award nominees in the festival over the years. And winners. And in fact, we're among the few festivals in the country that we serve as a platform to add to their eligibility list. So if you win 3 of our short awards, so that's Best Animated Short Award, Best Live Action Short Award, or Best Documentary Short Award, that if you win here, then you're shortlisted for the Oscars. And
wow.
We're fortunate to have that status, but you know, we've been around for 45 years. You know, the industry respects our programming, and obviously we have a large base of audience support along the way.
That's really impressive. I'm not as familiar with what the process is in terms of what qualifies for awards or anything like that. So yeah, that's really fantastic. Although I did, like, as I was kind of thinking back or seeing some of the things that I've been invited to for CIFF in the past, a lot of them ended up being ones like that became award winners or became really well-known prestige movies. Like,
I just think I think a lot of people aren't aware of all this content that's under the commercial radar. I mean, you know, obviously what you see in advertisements on TV or in radio or on the internet are the big studio films, which is great. I mean, it's an important industry in our country, but we just like to shed light on films that don't have that kind of marketing budget that, you know, really have value. Some of these filmmakers, some of these directors aren't even really filmmakers, but they care so much about a cause.
Sure.
That it's a passion project. They'll max out all their credit cards. They'll beg all their friends for money, and they're not going to make money off these films for the most part. I mean, every once in a while, there'll be something where, there'll be a big deal that Netflix will ink or Amazon will ink or the like, but oftentimes you're not in this industry to make a buck. You're in the industry to make change.
Unless you're Marvel.
Right. Yes. Exactly. I'm talking about the under the commercial radar side of things. Not, of course, the commercial folks they're definitely there to make money, because the productions are so expensive these days. It's just so much money. We, as a film festival, we have our own niche, and we are fortunate to receive a lot of foundation and corporate support to make it as accessible as possible. And that's what we're going to continue to do.
Speaking of that niche, you kind of talked a little bit about the fact that some of the films may only be available in the Ohio area. Is that something that the film festival tries to specifically and intentionally focus on, is like film from the Ohio area?
Well, let me just quasi answer your question first, and then I will answer your question. So we don't put those restrictions on. It's the distributors or the people that own the film say, right, you can only have so many streams, and in some cases they say you can only screen it in these areas. But But yes, to directly answer your question, we do have a local heroes competition, which are films made in Ohio, about Ohioans, or the like. And there's a robust program every year, and it totally varies in terms of what's in there. There's actually a film called Swan Song that was filmed in Sandusky. And it's going to be the anchor of our Dreamcatcher program, where we're giving an award to an LGBTQ plus filmmaker by the name of Todd Stevens, who was born and raised there. And that is the third in a trilogy of films that he's made there. So that's a great example of a local heroes film, and it's called Swan Song.
Awesome. Cool.
I have a question for you.
What's up?
How many movies do you think you watch a week?
Well, remember, I'm not the programmer. So the number's gonna be a lot lower than you think it's gonna be. This time of year, I'm trying to watch as much of our content as possible. So, you know, I'm watching, let's say, a dozen movies a week, just so when I interview a filmmaker for a filmmaker conversation, I have good questions, and, you know, I want to be ready for that. But in the summer, I'm just outside a lot. I mean, I'm in a neighborhood where I walk everywhere or bike everywhere. I mean, with Ohio weather, not unlike Illinois weather, you know, when the weather is good, I want to be outside.
That's fair. So
drinking beer on a patio or something.
Okay. I just imagined, because you love movies. So, I mean, Nick watches a lot of movies a week, I think.
Yep. What's Nick's answer to that?
I bet it's a lot lower once again than you think it is.
Okay.
I mean, this is a ongoing theme, and it always seems like I'm like mad at my wife about this. It's just the reality of nature. But I mean, it's fewer movies since I met you. I now actually have, you know, people to talk to and things to do with my day, and you inspire me to go do things in life.
I make him go outside.
Yeah, the whole outside enjoying the weather thing. I was perfectly happy to stay inside and watch movies and back to back. And I mean, I remember we were starting, we didn't finish it, but that new The Last Blockbuster documentary on Netflix, and I can remember some of what those people talk about, of like, you would go to Video Spectrum in Bowling Green, Ohio, because that was the place, and it fought hard. Like, it died around the same time Blockbuster did nationally. Like, it managed to, anyway, it didn't get put out of business by them. But so it was a thing. Like, it was exciting. You'd go and you'd get 2 to 3 movies. And if you had like a really big weekend with friends or something, you might get like 5 or 6, because you're doing like a Bond movie marathon or something like that. And that would be the whole weekend. Like, you would do nothing but watch those movies. And I love that. That's awesome to me. That's a whole thing. But it's only fun to me when you're doing that, like, with other people, because then you're talking about it. You're not usually talking during, but, you know, you talk in between the movies. And yeah. Anyway.
Sorry, I dimmed your light, Nick.
You dimmed my light.
Well, Patrick, do you have anything else that you want to say just about your love of prestige movies or the film, anything before we move on?
No, I don't think so. I mean, to me, awards are awards. And sometimes, you know, there's some political component as to why a film is getting an award. But I would just go back to my point about, you know, shedding light on films under the commercial radar and being open to watching a film with a subtitle, or watch a documentary about a topic that you know nothing about, you know, that kind of thing.
That will be our next conversation for me.
I was going to say, not to throw her under the bus, but Danielle kind of was like considering this to be homework more than any other, you know, film that we probably watched for this podcast.
No, oh, then that's my fault. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
And there's no apology, because
I learned a lot and I was engaged the whole time.
She was. And she even afterwards was like, wow, that was really interesting, actually.
Where's my notebook?
I don't know where your notebook is. We'll look for that in a second. I was going to say, though, one last thing before we cut to break, Patrick, if you would give a plug, where can our listeners support CIFF if they want to donate, or also if they just want to, since they can this year, you know, participate? We've got listeners actually from all over the entire United States. So how can they get tickets? How can they participate in this coming weeks?
Thank you. The 45th Cleveland International Film Festival that we're calling CIFF 45 Streams will run from April 7th through the 20th. Our program is now live on our website at clevelandfilm.org. Our ticket prices are pretty much almost half of what they would normally be in an in-person year. So it's they're $10 per individual stream, and if you become a member, that goes down to $8. And I would just suggest that you take a look at the site, and maybe you hail from some country you have an ancestral connection to, and let's just say it's Hungary. you look for the Hungarian film, or if you care about the environment, go to our global health competition. If you care about racial equity, check out our groundbreaker award in racial equity educational program. So we always say that there's a little bit in this film festival for everyone. You just got to find it.
Yeah, that sounds. Now I'm thinking, I'm like, what categories would I want to go to? I think the racial equity, the LGBTQ. If there's anything about drag queens, I'm there.
We have two great trans films, and we're talking drag queens from the 1950s. Like, you know, it's a historical doc. I think it's called P.S. Burn This Letter, because of course in the 1950s it was a very different world, and that was not accepted at all. So that's a fascinating film about drag queens.
That does sound awesome. All right, we'll have to get our tickets.
I mean, yeah, I'm definitely down. And the barrier's never been easier for somebody listening. So, you know, if you, like you said, you don't have to travel to get there. If there's a film that you find interesting, just choose to be able to be there for that film from your own home.
Yep. So most films are USA and territories, and we'll have a whole bunch of filmmaker content online that you can watch. We'll have a third season of our podcast series, Sif Speaks, and just the there'll be so many different ways to engage throughout the entire festival. And you can vote. You can help determine winners.
Oh, that is cool. Very cool.
Excellent. All right. Well, we will go ahead and...
You're forgetting a segment.
Oh, my goodness. You're right. I completely forgot. She's
don't know how this podcast works.
I literally have it written on a board up in front of us. And you know, I wanted to make sure that was the case. So, yeah, I totally forgot about our Closer Through Science segment. So we need to ask you, Patrick, a question. Danielle, what is the closer?
No, you tell me. What is Closer to Science?
She hates this. So this is a series of questions that we have. It's her favorite segment. It's a series of questions that we have from a psychology study that was done that basically showed that complete strangers could ask these series of questions from each other, and it would make them feel emotionally closer to even strangers. And so it is literally these series of questions make you feel closer to the person that who you are asking and answering them with. So we have our guests get closer to us and our listeners, and we encourage our listeners to also share their answers to these questions using the hashtag Closer Through Science. So,
okay, so these are very random questions, not on topic at all, but the next question we have on our list, Patrick, is what does friendship mean to you?
Oh, wow. I've never answered that question before in any interview in my 50 years, but let me think about that. So I just think that human beings are social in nature, and I think it's important to have friendships so you have an emotional bond, you know, and you know, certainly... You know, we start with our family members, but you build your larger family of people that you're not related to. And I mean, it sometimes can be a support network if you're in need, or you can support others when they are in need in one way or the other. You know, for example, if somebody's, you know, looking for a new job, you help them with the job search, that kind of thing. So I just think it's a friendship is part of a social network where you support people, they support you, and you know, you make your own life better because of people from diverse backgrounds in your life. How's that for an answer?
That was a good answer.
That was a superb answer. Like, it literally, you just launched into it, and I think our listeners are going to doubt that you were put on the spot there, because you're like, oh, I've never thought about that. Here's this perfect answer that...
No, I mean, we didn't prep you because that's such a random question, but thank you.
Okay.
I think that was very well answered and very well thought out.
Now, did the hosts answer that question, or do just the guests answer?
No, we just
question?
Pimp you out.
Yeah, we're just...
Okay. Okay, fair.
we will usually answer on our social medias, so individuals have to follow us. And when it is just the two of us, one of us answers it. But we let the guests be the ones to answer those questions so that we can get closer to you. So listeners, please do share your answers to those questions and look for Danielle and I's answers on our social medias using the hashtag Closer Through Science. Before we break, one more last time, Patrick, what is the website for CIFF again?
ClevelandFilm.org.
All right, ClevelandFilm.org. And now we will take a brief break. Listeners, you'll have to listen to us plugging other things. I think we're still actually using the ad where we like talk on our phones.
Okay.
Anyway,
they'll listen to it.
Point being, we will come back after the break and we will be discussing what film, Patrick?
American Factory, directed by Stephen Bognar and Julia Riker.
All right. So we will see you all in a few minutes.
Give your money to the Cleveland International Film Festival. Okay, I have to pee.
In love with movies. Da-da-da. Da-da-da. In love with movies.
And we're back.
Welcome back, movie lovers. Thank you all for sticking through with our quick little plugs there. We are back with Patrick Shepherd, and we are going to be discussing the movie American Factory. Maybe a little bit of some of its sort of predecessor, a documentary short, Last Truck, may I think sort of trickle into our conversation. But American Factory is, I believe, produced originally, or at least released by Netflix originally, correct, Patrick?
Yes. So it was, it did a few festivals first before it went on Netflix.
Okay.
But it did win the Academy Award for Best Documentary in 2020.
I was going to say, and that was right before the pandemic, right? It was the...
Right.
That's right. How recent, it feels like ages ago when I first heard about this movie being an Oscar winner. And now I'm like, oh man, that was literally the last Oscar awards ceremony. Mm-hmm. Anyway, continue.
Yeah. And I think it was the first film that President Barack and Michelle Obama supported through their filmmaking ventures. And it's just such an important story to tell. And in my mind, it's so unique because no factory would have a company that would let pretty much unfettered access to cameras and people working, you know, like on the clock, answering questions and talking. And just, I think it really pulled the curtain back and you saw things that you would never normally see in any kind of documentary. And I'm guessing that the Chinese management are probably regretting that they offered all that access. But to me, it's such an enlightening film by, you know, not even just two of Ohio's best filmmakers and Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichert, but I think they're among the best documentary filmmakers in the country. And they even have a new film out now called 9 to 5, which is based on the women's rights movement in the workplace in the 1970s. So
that is very cool. Yeah. Totally agree. I appreciate a lot of that additional context. So yeah, listeners, if you're listening to this, and we'll talk about this as we move forward, I don't want to get too much into it yet, but yeah, I too, when I like sort of realized at where the story, so to speak, goes throughout, I'm like, they gave a lot of, they just let you see everything, and people may not be so happy about that. But yeah, so it was released in 2019 wide on Netflix. You can watch it right now today. You know, if you want to go ahead and pause, go watch it first and then listen to us continue to talk about it. But it was an Oscar winner, you know, and it is an Oscar winner for a documentary feature by some people from Ohio.
This might be one of my first ever Oscar movies I've watched. That's embarrassing to say, but I'm not like, I don't watch the Oscar movies that much.
I would almost guarantee it is the first Oscar award winning documentary that you
Absolutely.
Have ever seen.
Yeah.
You've probably, I mean, like,
I saw La La Land.
Yeah. I was going to say there are movies that were Oscar nominees that you've seen. There's some more popular ones that have been up there, you know, the larger conversations. But so that's the basic movie facts for everyone, the sort of directors, filmmakers, where you can get them. So before we move forward with your more personal story about it, we need to have our Danny's Dingle segment, my favorite segment of the podcast.
Time for Danny's Dingle.
So Danny, take it away.
GM gone. Fu Yao is here. Chinese dictator? Question mark. Not good stuff People hurt. There's an army of workers. Hopeful. Interesting. I learned.
That's my I learned. All right.
Wow, that was great. You do this for every episode?
Yeah, we started probably 5 or 6 episodes. I think we did maybe this first season is when, or the second season is when we started doing
it. It turned into just like one word phrases. It was originally just me like describing the movie, but now it's just words.
I like this bit more, right, Patrick? Where she does the one word phrases and it summarizes what the movie is just from her perspective.
Yeah, I think she did a great job. I mean, that really gives you a sense of what happens.
Speaking of their perceptions or sense of what happens, the next segment we have is love story. So what would be your love story, Patrick, with this movie? Why did you select it for us? What's your personal sort of attachment to it? You know, all that jazz.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Wellington, Ohio, where my grandfather and my dad had a Chevrolet Oldsmobile dealership, so General Motors. And grandpa had the business from 1928 until 1983. So there's a plant in the Dayton area called the Moraine Assembly Plant that made many of the vehicles that sat on the lot of that dealership. And, you know, like a Chevy S10 truck is a good example of a vehicle that came out of Dayton from that space. And you referenced it, Nick, but that was a General Motors plant that was shut down. And the same two filmmakers made a film about the closure of a plant, which was also just another type of film that you've never seen that kind of content before. I mean, maybe others have. I've never seen another film before or since about watching the pain of those people losing their jobs. And I just still have the image in my mind of that guy rolling his tool chest to his truck on the last day after the last vehicle was completed. And, you know, then it's interesting. Very rarely do documentaries have sequels, but this one does, because Fuyao, a company from China, invested a lot of money in that plant to make auto glass. And I believe they currently employ maybe a little over 2,000 people in Southwest Ohio. And you see the impact of automation on the economy. And you also see a bit of cultural difference, if you will. we can get into that. And I, by the way, I want to preface this by saying, you know, we're recording this on the heels of the unfortunate killings in Atlanta. And I just want to personally say that, you know, that is abhorrent, and anybody that is racist in any way, be it Black, Asian, Native, Latinx, any kind of background, that just should not be acceptable in our society. The reason why I say that is because there is a fair amount of discord between the Chinese people that are in Dayton and the Americans. But I don't want the listeners to construe the fact that we're anti-Chinese here. It's just, it's part of the narrative of the story.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is something that I think we need to be sensitive to, but I honestly had not even necessarily kind of occurred to me. And maybe that's because in this movie, it feels less like race and more like culture, as you kind of already said. And there is very big tensions between those two cultures, but I'm sure someone could see this and absolutely with a certain mindset would watch it as sort of like a very just anti-Chinese general sentiment. And that's certainly not how I wouldn't even personally for me say, like, and we'll get into this, and I hope I don't upset you, Pat, with, you know, a side or anything that we would take. I don't necessarily think that the side of the Chinese and their way of wanting to do things is the wrong way or anything. It obviously has impacts to things. But it by no means is like, oh, they're wrong, and the American workers and the unions are 100%, you know, faultless, so to speak. It's just a clashing of two different ways of trying to do things and very different priorities of different groups of people meeting. But it's by no means, you know, yeah, it should not be taken any further than that.
Yeah,
And all of this under the context of mass globalization of the world economy and technology driving so much invention that you don't need as many workers as you used to. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, I could be wrong, but I didn't think this documentary, like a lot of times documentaries have a lean, right? You were saying they have a message. To me, I don't think this one had a lean. I think it really did show both sides of things, and you were able to connect with people from China who are like upending their lives to have to come here. And then the Americans who are like trying to say like, hey, we've always done this the American way. Now someone new is coming in and changing it. And so you get to see both sides of it. And I don't think, like you said, I don't think they said one was wrong or right. They just showed you both, and then you're allowed to make your own opinions from there.
Yeah. And if there was any kind of lean, I think it's more anti-management in general than it is anti-Chinese. I mean, because especially now having watched Last Truck, there's a little bit of that. It's not too heavily handed, but understandably, it's the sort of management labor tensions that exist. And I think that those would exist and did exist regardless of other things. It's just sort of how things are chosen. But I will also say, I agree with you about the automation thing, because I was thinking about Andrew Yang's book and some other things discussing automation of society, and we have to kind of make choices because the automation, you know, is coming, and the impact that that has on the economy is coming. And I think it's very interesting. It's almost like a sudden surprise or a slap in the face at the end of this mm-hmm. movie, because that's not really the theme throughout. Mm-hmm. There's just this theme of like trying to get to know these people, getting to know the individuals, as Danny mentioned, from both sides, the motivations, the reasons, and everything like that. And then the sort of more or less final scene where they're walking through the factory, and it is literally the management walking through saying, yeah, we're going to be able to fire four people here for a robotic arm. And we're going to, you know, we're looking to cut two people here. And I was just like, oh, now that hurt. Like, that is just like viewing these individuals that you've spent now almost 2 hours getting to know and just not seeing them as anything more than cogs in the machine. And that was mm-hmm. rough.
Definitely.
The Q&A that took place at the film festival in 2019 was just so compelling. I mean, it was all these basically Dayton native people alongside the two directors, and just a lot of people asking questions about comparing their jobs when they were at General Motors and then when they were making probably more than twice as much as they're making now. And just I remember in the Q&A, one of the people saying, you know, if I need to go to a wedding over a weekend, I have to have perfect attendance for X amount of time. I don't remember exactly how much it was, but, you know, just even having time off, or of course, safety in the workplace, which was also very addressed. There was that one gentleman who never had an injury throughout all of his years at GM, and within a couple of years at the new plant, he had some kind of foot injury. So, you know, it's there is a quality of life issue here. And what I would say, it's interesting, you know, that these people had great union wages in the GM context, and now it's totally different. And I also thought what was fascinating, and Danielle, to your point, I think you're right. The filmmakers do present it, so you make your own decisions from it, but you see the Chinese, their expectations of a way of life are growing, while the Ohioans are struggling from kind of the theory of higher expectations, what they had before and what they have now.
Yeah, one line that I think really stood out to me was like I think they were in China at this time, and they were saying, like the two managers were talking, or the American who spoke fluent Mandarin, which I thought was very cool. And they were saying, your workers get 8 days off a month, but that's the weekends. Yeah. And to me, as an American, you don't think, oh, I get 8 vacation days a month. You just think like, oh, I have to work literally 5 days a week, and like I get a bit of a break. Weekends are not long enough. So it's exactly what you're saying, is that's the mindset of like, you, well, he even said it, you work to live. Wait, live to work.
Yeah, the chairman at the end of it somewhere says, yeah, the point of life is to work, essentially. Like he said, sometimes I get depressed or sometimes I think about, have I had an impact on the environment. He's like, did I maybe poison things? And he's just like, yeah, but I only think about that when I'm sad because, you know, I live to work. And it was just like, wow. All right. One thing I thought was very fascinating as I was thinking about it and thinking about those cultural differences, because as an IO psychologist, a lot of this was also fascinating to me. And like you said, the work-life balance and sort of the fact that it is our culture that we live in that defines what is an appropriate work-life balance. And I think a lot of people in this country forget that it wasn't that long ago that you were expected to work like the people are just assuming you're supposed to work, from the Chinese plants. And it was the impact of labor unions and other, and then mobilizations and political arms to sort of say like, oh no, we're going to create this 40-hour work week and we're going to give you your weekends and we're not going to let kids under 16 work, you know, and all these things that I think we take for granted are things that we think of as like 40 hours is, you know, the minimum. And we think of the 40 hours as the minimum now, but it's like, that at a time we had to like pull it back because that law existed and became a thing where we were like, nah, you know what? People are working 80 hours a week and we decided that wasn't healthy. And so it's all about kind of balance and give and take. And I think that it's just sort of a culture that is at a different industrial stage, how do you balance that or how do you figure that out? Because I've been thinking even here, it's like maybe 40 hours is more than is appropriate for, you know, and it all just depends on what you define as what's important in life.
Go to Europe, right? It's like completely different over there, even from our work. So,
yeah.
And I got to tell you, if I could get one question answered from the CEO of that company is why? Do they not have enough of a workforce in China? Why invest all this money? Why take, I think, over 200 people, uproot them from Asia, bring them to the Midwest of the United States and start this plant, which I don't think was profitable until 2018, but that's after more automation came into place. And I think that was after the drive for the union had failed. But why, why Dayton, Ohio? I mean, that's, or anywhere in the United States for that matter. That's what I'm curious about.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. And I was saying to Nick last night when we were watching it, like, it's almost, this story is not one that we see a lot. I think you were saying this is like, it's not a story that's really told because we think of like, as Americans, like maybe us going over to China or us going to other countries and doing the same thing. And it was very interesting to see it flipped and having someone from another culture come in and do that here. I just thought it's a perspective that I've never seen. And can you hear our cats playing with plastic?
Okay. I was just about to say, I don't know if our microphones are picking this up, but listeners, please forgive us if the kittens playing in plastic is something you hear right now.
Anyways, it was just, it's because as Americans, we almost have this view like we're in charge. We can create new things and we can go wherever we want and put our companies there. But like having companies come here and change our, I don't know. It was just very interesting.
Well, because we talked about it again, IO perspective. I sometimes teach the idea of like expatriatism and students needing to learn about like, hey, when you go work in other cultures or when you're blending cultures, you have to do things where you sort of intentionally explain different cultures to each other, you know, and they very kind of early on in this show that training that existed where they're essentially explaining to, you know, the Chinese workers what it's like to be in America and the sort of the attitudes that Americans have and things of that nature. And we normally traditionally teach it in the sense of like, oh, Americans management going over there or something like that and having to teach them how to work with other workers. And so to see the flip side was really kind of cool and fascinating for me.
Mm-hmm. I didn't like it, but the scenes that were very entertaining was when he first started walking through the plant, Fu Yao, that's his name, right? Fu Yao himself,
is that the CEO's name, Fu Yao? No.
No, I don't remember his name, but I think it's CAO is his last name. I don't know how you pronounce that, but Fu Yao is the name of the company.
Yeah. I noted the fact that they just kept referring to him as the chairman.
The chairman.
The chairman, which is a very communist party way to kind of do things.
But as he's walking through the American plant, he's just like questioning things like, you decorated wrong. And he's actually talking about like the fire alarm that's on the top of the wall. He's like, you should not have put that there. And they were explaining like, no, that's the law. And he's like, well, that's not how it's going to go. I don't like that there. And the same thing with like asking about putting a roof or something when there was going to be that ceremony. He's like, in October, the weather will be like this. Like almost like he was in charge of the weather. The way that he wanted it was how it was going to happen. And then ironically, it happened and the weather was perfect in October, but still.
That being said, anybody that lives in the Midwest knows that in October, you could even have snow. I mean, depending on where you are in October. So he totally lucked out. I mean, that was
a gamble.
You know, yeah, it was he probably didn't think it was, but that was an enormous battle. And I don't know how much you've talked about your background on some of the other episodes, but
any of it can be shared regardless. So,
okay. All right. Well, your dad was a well-respected political leader in Northwest Ohio for decades. And he worked with Sherrod Brown and worked to elect Sherrod Brown in many campaign cycles. And that clip of Sherrod basically advocating for union organizing in the plant. And then of course the subsequent reaction by not even the Chinese leadership, but also the American leadership was to me a fascinating portion of this film.
I agree. And to me, I could be wrong, but it seems like the guys who were in charge first before they got replaced were doing things because that's what they knew they were supposed to do, but they didn't really believe it. Like that guy who was like, yeah, we'll move. If it was up to me, I would have moved the fire alarm. No, you wouldn't have. Because in America, we don't even think about that stuff. You know, it's just like, that's the norm. That's the law.
Or there was something having to do with a garage door or something that the chairman was like, no, that garage door can't go there. And he's like, well, we already ordered it. And he's like, I don't care. You gotta replace that. And he's like, that's $35,000. And the woman who's translating just kind of shrugs. Like,
yeah.
So it's like he gets his way. I mean, you know, he is the chairman. How about that portion where, apparently they're not observing laws like don't pour paint into a sewer, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Americans kind of seemed like, oh, we know this isn't right, but also like, this is our job and we want to be on the side of the company, which I think was very interesting.
And let's be fair here. I mean, for American industry in the 19th and 20th century, until the very end of the last century, there were not laws in place to stop that kind of thing to happen. So here in Cleveland, the Cuyahoga River was so polluted that it didn't just burn one time, it burned regularly because American manufacturer where they were just dumping things into tributaries and into the river itself. So this is definitely something that's not exclusive to any part of the world, but you know, there are reasons why those laws are in place. And that's why fish are now in the Cuyahoga River and clean up.
Yeah, no, that same thing happened in the Chicago fire. Some history facts, like it literally jumped the river because it was so polluted. And so that's why it caused so much destruction because of the pollution. It was able to get to the whole dang city.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just very interesting.
And I think that highlights too, though, the fact that it's less cultural in the movie. Well, less like racial, certainly in the movie, and more like management versus, labor, so to speak, because the management, even when it was American management, was towing the line. They were, you know, he was very pissed at Sherrod Brown. But I will say there was a bit of a difference. Like, it was just like, we know we don't want a union because we know it's, you know, not great. And so I am doing it. He seemed pissed at Sherrod Brown almost more like he was just pissed that he didn't get the heads up or pissed that he like, you know, because he clearly kind of. He made that move without notifying anyone. You know what I mean? But yeah, I thought that was very interesting. And the cultural difference on like pollution and things like that, I think is a very good point. And that's where we eventually get into things with the union in this show. And I think that's important to know that things like unions, you know, tied with the environmental movements or tied with the labor movements and the fact that you should have living wages and shouldn't be, you know, doing back-breaking labor for 12 hours a day. Those things would still very much exist in this country if it weren't for things like labor unions that fought for them decades ago.
Yeah. What about that guy that was like going into that 200 degree room? He's like, oh, I do it about 10 minutes every hour. Like, how is his body not burning or melting? It's just super crazy. The one thing I wanted to point out, and I noticed it early on in this documentary, is like the music. They do a super good job shaping the scene without words, but using music. So like understanding the tone of what they're trying to portray. So at the beginning, it's a lot of just like, oh, it's silly. We're getting to know each other. Things are kind of happy and light and jovial. And like they're making friendships and it's kind of funny, the cultural differences. And then the music really starts to change when they show the danger in the workplace. And like, you realize then that you're supposed to start getting a little nervous and like start thinking about the union as like important. So I just thought they did a really great job because there's not a lot of dialogue. I'd say there's less dialogue than there is dialogue in this documentary. It's just a lot of like, this is what's happening. But the music does a great job of telling the story for you.
I'm so glad you said that because, you know, film is art, and Julia and Steve are artists, and that is part of the puzzle of making a film, and their use of music in this film is nothing short of extraordinary. So I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, and
I totally agree. And that is just an example of one of the things I was talking about, like in terms of why you can appreciate movies is when you start to see those layers. Or I've even, Danielle's mother at one point asked, why do you like comic books? And I kind of said, because it's cinematic. But as I was explaining to Danielle or other times, like there's layers to it, like the art itself and the story being told, like, and all of that is true of filmmaking as well, where there's the music, there's the way you've shot something, there's the story that was written for it, there's the acting that happens in it when it's not a documentary. But yeah, all of that was very cool.
Yeah. And I think that they really do a good job of telling stories of people too. And you don't just see American people, like you see all the people, which I really liked. And then when they go to China, I liked when they went to China. That was very interesting to see the other side of it too and how they're running it. Same company, but it starts out with them singing that they have like a theme song for their company.
And the impression you get is that like, this is a thing that they start every day at their corporate office with this sort of company anthem, you know what I mean? The same, it'd be like if at schools we started every workday with, you know, the United States national anthem or something like that, but instead it is for the company specifically. It was very interesting.
Yeah. And then just
having, how about that? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say, and having the Americans come in and just like seeing the how different it is. I just got one note. Why did that guy go to that very fancy meeting in China wearing a Jaws t-shirt? That really threw me off.
I don't think he was impressing anybody with that, but I had the same thought. And wasn't it surreal to see after all of the presentation, like kind of the music and the dance of the Chinese, and then the Americans go on stage and perform YMCA by the Village People? Boy, isn't that interesting? I mean, I just wonder what's going on in the Americans' heads. I'm wondering what the Chinese are thinking. You know, it's fascinating.
I don't want to, again, speaking about not making it a racial thing or anything, but conspiracy theorist wise, there was a small part of me that was like, are they making this choice intentionally to
make fun of,
like kind of make fun of them or embarrass them? Mm-hmm. Which there's part of me, it's like, well, other people were dancing on stage kind of looking ridiculous too, but not necessarily the employees of the company. Instead, yeah, they're almost like making the Americans the clowns as a part of the.
But how many times in America have you seen us do something like that to other cultures? Of like, true. If you're Native American,
oh, yes.
Dress up in a headdress or, you know, things like that. So again, yeah. I really like this documentary showing the other perspective of things.
But it also reminds me to your question that you were asking, like you would ask the chairman if you had a chance, of why. And there's a part of me that's like, again, conspiracy theorist, you know, you hear things in politics and things of that nature. I wonder if there is any element of sort of trying to get an economic foothold, because when they go to China is when you start to realize, even though it's a capitalist sort of endeavor and there's this company, that they are very intimately tied to the Communist Party and the government of China. You know, in fact, that like his brother-in-law, like the person who's like the party leader and also like somehow tied to the company, is his brother-in-law. So there's this nepotism going on, but also this very intimate tie with like the government as a part of the company as well.
Yeah, that was my question, is in China, they're very, like they are in the union. So it's interesting that they're so anti-union in America. And I just didn't understand. Like, is the union different? Like, why is it a benefit there?
I don't have a 100% fact-based answer for you, but I think that that's more of a political structure in China, and ours is more about organizing for workers' rights. I think that's the American context of a union, which really, since the early 1980s, the labor union movement has been struggling to maintain its hold. And, you know, there was a bit of drama in this film. You wondered how the vote was going to go.
Yeah.
Right? So that was a big plot point. And I, you know, another facet of this film that you would not normally see, and one of these was just an audio recording, but that Labor Relations Institute that was hired by the company, and that people had to, I think in some cases, go to 3 sessions where they kind of scared the hell out of them, you know? And I think one of the workers acknowledged that the younger ones were probably a little more scarable than maybe the folks that worked at the GM plant before it closed.
Yeah, because they were getting paid more than double their wages,
I mean, in some cases,
being in the union.
I remember the conversation of like that same guy who was concerned with the people who were working in bad conditions of 200 degrees. He was walking around or like was collecting a suggestion box thing or something like that. And some other, you know, just line worker came up to him and started complaining about, you know, they're going to turn this into a factory space. Why aren't you doing anything about that? And just like starts yelling and shouting at him. And then kind of is like, well, I hope they turn your office into a production space too. Like clearly just this sort of animosity towards that individual because he was management, even though that guy's whole job is to try to like make the conditions better for employees because he's perceived as management. That becomes, you know, a tension and an issue. And you mentioned the drama of the vote. I thought this documentary did a phenomenal job. I actually had a note in my notebook of like, I legitimately thought the way that they were doing with the music and the way that they were building up for it, it was going to be a clear yes, unionized, because I had not known the history of this. So when we knew we were watching this thing, I thought it was going to be this great success story of a Chinese company coming in. And then that kind of clearly starts to not be the case. And I was like, well, it's going to be that the union prevails. And then like, they're setting it up to make it look like that's going to be the case. And then it is like, nope, defeated 2-1. Like,
yeah.
I thought the filmmakers did a phenomenal job with things like that, of really kind of building that tension and building that drama and telling a story.
While we're on the topic of labor organizing, I want to take this opportunity to mention Julia and Steve's newest film, which came out this year. It's called 9 to 5, The Story of a Movement, which talks about how women organized in the 1970s. And these were women that were sexually harassed, that they were not paid very well. They were expected to do things like get coffee and do all things that were unrelated to their regular jobs. It premiered on PBS, I believe, on February 1st, and then it ran on demand through the month of February, but I think it's coming to Netflix. So if any of your listeners appreciated the work of Julia and Steve, who, by the way, as a quick sidebar, live in Yellow Springs, Ohio, which is some of the most progressive territory in the Midwest. And Dave Chappelle lives there and just walks around downtown, you know?
Wow.
That's right outside of Dayton. In fact, when Dave Letterman went to interview Chappelle for his series, they did it in Yellow Springs, which is extraordinary. But nonetheless, I believe that 9 to 5 is going to be on Netflix. They are just incredible documentary filmmakers. And that's just another great story that has never been told. And I think it took them maybe a whole decade to make that one. And it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And fits really well with Whitman International Women's History Month, given that it is the month of March right now. So if you can find it on there, or just, you know, add it to your docket or add it to your list of things that you would do as well. Yeah. Thank you for.
Yeah, I'll watch it. I like ladies.
I also think that ties into that, the idea of balance we were kind of talking about, is that it's where the power lies. And if the power lies only in one set of hands at either end of the spectrum, so to speak, that's when you get problems. And the thing I think people have forgotten, at least me personally, my own perceptions in this country, is how hard and for how long the fight was to get some of the power in the actual working man's hands, so to speak. And as you mentioned, Pat, since the 1980s, that has been slowly being eroded and degraded and that power has been taking away and lessened. It's really kind of sad because it creates those situations where you can have people that get, in my opinion, abused, you know?
Yeah. I will say the women in the 9 to 5 story are so inspirational. It's not like they were necessarily picketing. They actually did media events where they announced the worst boss, and the TV stations would show up. And then strangely, the boss he liked being on TV, so he didn't mind getting this award, you know, and so misogynistic. And it's even difficult to imagine what these women were enduring in the 1970s. And by the way, another sidebar, if you've heard of the film 9 to 5 that has Dolly Parton, Jane Fonda, and Lily Tomlin, that movement is what inspired that film, because many women wanted to kill their bosses. But since they couldn't kill them, they organized.
That's a lot of motivation for women. Like, a lot of women want to kill their husbands, but because they can't, they just kidding.
So instead, kinda, they watch movies.
Kind of kidding. So I will say that I was looking for a message for this movie, and I think there was a lot of them. So towards the end, and it seems like they wrapped it up in a nice little bow at the end to be able to be like, these are the things we're talking about. That capitalism is bad. That's what I got from this.
Unfettered capitalism, I will personally add for myself.
Especially in the chairman's response to, like, I was happier when I was poor. Like, that was his final thing that he was saying. And I thought that was really interesting to be like, this guy's literally a billionaire. And he was happier when he could hear the frogs chirp or something like that, which is very, very interesting. I also wrote, robots are bad. I'm anti-robot. Nick knows this. I'm just like, I don't like the idea of automation, because you're getting rid of so many jobs, and capitalism is pushing that, right? Because you want more, 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 quicker, quicker, quicker.
Yeah.
So you have to put the robots, because the humans can't work fast enough. So I'm just anti-robot. And it was just very, I just really liked the human side of this movie, where you got to see everyone's story. You got to see, I think his name was Wong, who was like friends with the guy who showed him guns and let him ride horses. And then his family eventually came to America. I like that they formed a friendship, even though the American ended up getting fired. And the chairman, even though he's creepy, he's almost like an actual like movie villain. Like that someone looks like that, you would cast him for a villain. He even had like, you saw the human side of him where he's like, I just think that Americans are, he said, hostile towards the Chinese people. And it's interesting that he had that. He said the American managers didn't work because Americans are hostile. And it's just like, you know, we always have this perception as Americans is like, obviously we had someone in office who was saying this constantly. Like people think Chinese people are bad, you know, other countries are bad, but they feel the same way. And it's just, it's really interesting to see that, like, maybe if you just talked to someone or got to know them on a human level, these things wouldn't exist. So
yeah.
I don't know. Overall, I really liked this documentary. I really did learn a lot. I'm not a documentary person, but maybe I will start to be. My only critique, Patrick, don't be mad at me, is it was about an hour too long for me. It was a longer documentary, but I did learn.
It was. You're right. Typically, a documentary is about 90 minutes. I think there was just so much to unpack that this is a longer one than usual, but I get it. I personally have trouble with films that are longer than 90 minutes, which is why you don't see me going to a lot of commercial 3-hour films, because unless I'm sitting on my couch and I can pause it, I just can't stay in a seat for that long.
Well, the Snyder Cut was just released. So, you know, that's what I'm going to be doing later this weekend. It's like more than 4 hours long. It's ridiculous. Patrick, were there any other sort of last minute comments, thoughts you wanted to make sure that we shared, anything we haven't touched on?
No, I really appreciate you taking a look at this film. I know it might be different from what you've experienced in the past, but to me, this is a perfect example of the type of film that you'll see at the Cleveland International Film Festival, because it makes you think about an issue that you've not thought about maybe in a particular way. And not that you have to be convinced into one opinion or the other, but it provokes your thought. And that's what we endeavor to do at our film festival, and film festivals across the country endeavor to do the same thing.
Yeah, I agree. I've never even thought about any of this because I just wasn't aware of it, you know? So to learn about it, to see the different perspectives on it was very interesting.
Yeah, I was going to say, because this was actually already on my Netflix list and has been since last year. And I was telling Danielle, I did a IO Psych movie nights thing where I streamed and shared different movies that are related to IO psychology, my topic. And this was one I almost shared. And now I would say, like, if I ever do it again, I will definitely share it, because I think there's a lot of anyone who's listening. I know I've got some students who are listeners. Check this one out. It's a lot of IO psychology topics that are very fascinating and will make you think about them in ways that a textbook won't. And I think that that's one of the beauties of filmmaking, is it can connect with you in an emotional way where you see it then a little bit differently. The only other thing I had to say besides that was my one note about, I thought it was fascinating when they first sort of introduced some of the Chinese people coming over, and they said, what were your first impressions of Ohio? And you're smiling, Pat. I wonder if you're thinking of the same thing I am. He says, it's very flat. I couldn't help but laugh, because from Ohio, that's literally how I describe it to people all the time.
Yep, Western Ohio. You know Western Ohio well. There's some mountains on the southeast edge of Ohio, but it's all flatland in that part of the state. But yep, that's for sure.
All right. Well, then with that, I suppose we should probably go ahead and wrap things up with our ratings and renewals.
Yeah.
So, Danny, how many out of 5 hearts would you give it? And would you renew your vows?
Okay. I would give this a 4.5 out of 5 hearts. It was a very, very, very well done movie. Would I renew my vows? Now, I'm probably not going to watch it again, but I am happy that I learned things from it. How about you?
Yeah, I think... I'll give it 4.5 as well. It was very good. And especially as a documentary, I'm surprised you went that high. I would agree with you. I don't think it needs to be an hour shorter, but I personally think you could have shaved 20 to 30 minutes. There were some longer choices that were very cool and very artistic, but like lengthwise could have been pulled back, since there's so many non-dialogue scenes. And you would have gotten the same, in my opinion, feelings of it. But that's the only sort of criticism I would really have of it. And then in terms of renewal, I think I'm going to sort of give a tentative yes, not because I'm eager to go watch the whole movie again, but I can see myself at least utilizing scenes or referring to them, or maybe even I might take some clips and use them for teaching, for example. And so I'm sure I will see it, if not all of it, at portions again. Patrick, would you renew your vows? Do you feel the same way about it as you did when you saw it last year? And what rating would you give it?
Well, I'm very biased here because of my loyalty and love for Julia and Steve. They're friends. And they're brilliant filmmakers, so I have to give it a 5. The thing about documentaries is, I think if you watch it once and you get the essence of it, it's not like going to watch, you know, a Star Wars movie again.
Sure.
You know, I think for me, it's all about curiosity and learning, right? So I want to spend my time on another documentary so I can learn more. I don't tend to rewatch documentaries. I did rewatch this one for this podcast because I wanted it fresh in my mind, and I hadn't seen it in over probably a year and a half, 2 years. But
wow.
But I anytime, you know, there are filmmakers out there that you always watch whatever they release. And for me, I'm, as somebody who went to Bowling Green for history, I mean, Ken Burns is somebody who I'll probably watch anything that his team makes. And I will watch anything that Julia and Steve make, and hopefully we can screen it at the film festival as we have been for 20 some years.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you very much, Patrick. We appreciate that. One last attempt, because normally we close out the podcast giving everyone an opportunity to give their plugs. So what would you like to plug? Where can people find you? Where can people find CIFF?
The 45th Cleveland International Film Festival will run online April 7th through the 20th. You can visit our website at clevelandfilm.org. We encourage you to check out any of our 116 feature films and over 180 short films that will be presented in collected programs. And thank you for considering that.
And do you feel comfortable sharing or want to share your Twitter or anything like that?
Oh yeah, actually my course Shepherd is spelled 18,000 different ways. So, but my Twitter and Instagram are the same. It's just at Patrick Shepherd, S-H-E-P-H-E-R-D.
Yeah, that E is new. I usually see an A up in there with the Shepherd.
Oh, yeah. Seriously, I think there are like 8 different spellings. Sometimes there's 2 P's, sometimes there's an H, sometimes there's not, sometimes there's 2 A's. you know, it's just all over the place.
So Patrick is Shep Herd.
A sheep herder. He's a guessing sheep. I'm a descendant of sheep herders. Wow. From
is that where
somewhere.
That word came from?
Are you actually having that realization on the podcast right now?
No, I've done family history. I do have roots in Scotland and England. I will say that. So they were probably herding sheep over there. So,
all right, Danny. And what would you like to plug? What's going on with you and improv and everything like that?
Oh, yeah. Every other Sunday night, you can come see me in Rec League through Comedy Sports at 7 p.m. and vote for me in Karaoke, the search for the most okay karaoke singer. I'm in the top six, y'all, so I want to make it to the end.
And that's happening Monday nights, right?
Monday nights at 7 p.m.
for Karaoke
on Twitch.
And you can follow our social medias at letter N Love With Movies on Twitter is where a lot of those things get shared for that. You can also follow me on Twitter if you want to talk about things having to do with movies and IO psychology. And so very much a lot of the same stuff from this film. If you had any fascination in it, you'll probably like following me on Twitter at Nialfeba. That is N-I-A-L-F-E-B-A. All right. And with that, I love you, Danny.
Love you, Nick.
We love you, Patrick. Thank you very much for joining us. And we love you, movie lovers. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Follow us on Twitter at the letter N, Love With Movies, on Facebook at facebook.com/withmoviesandlove, and on Instagram and TikTok at inlove_withmovies.
You can email us at withmoviesinlove, that's all one word, withmoviesinlove@gmail.com, to share your own love stories with us, suggest future love topics that you might want to hear us discuss, or just to say, hey, we'd like to hear from you.
Hey.
All original music written and performed by Danny Smith, with our theme song remixed by Paul Brandt.
And this whole podcast was produced and edited by my lovely husband, Nicholas Baldwin.
And special thanks to Nick Stretchberry for our website and podcast art.
We did it!